Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We don't usually start the program with a stock quote, but sometimes that is the best way to get into things, you know? AAPL, Apple, is the stock of the day today, off almost 4.25%. Any guesses why out there? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 3rd of September, Wednesday. Good, as always, to have you with us. And yeah, Apple shares down a bit more than $4 today as the company denies its iCloud storage service was, and this is their word, breached in the celebrity photo hack this past weekend. It's all the more curious that stock dip is because Apple is about to come out with the latest and greatest version of its big moneymaker. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on the cloud and corporate fortunes.
This is the view from Apple headquarters. Actresses tweeting they felt violated when the nude photos were posted online. Speculation about weaknesses in iCloud security. And all this less than a week before a major announcement from Apple, likely the unveiling of an iPhone 6.
It's a hit to Apple.
Colin Gillis is a senior technology analyst at BGC Financial. He says Apple should be forward-looking and tell consumers, look, we have new tools that'll make you more secure, like biometrics, requiring a fingerprint instead of just a password to access accounts.
They will offer you solutions that you'll have, you know, extended on new iPhones to help prevent these types of things.
So just buy a new iPhone and everything will be fine, right? Not quite. Because the celebrity nude photo dump is so much more personal than a credit card data breach, we cringe and wonder, could something like that happen to us? Jeff Howe heads the Media Innovation Program at Northeastern University.
It's like someone, you know, going through your personal trash. I think it absolutely, you know, engenders a sense of violation.
That can make consumers more wary about sharing personal stuff online. Kathy Boyle is a senior mobile analyst at eMarketer. She's definitely noticed more consumer wariness.
But I think if you tell them that if you share a certain amount of your information with us in exchange for something valuable, then people seem to be more accepting of sharing their information.
So companies would have to offer us a discount or special treatment for our online data. Otherwise, hey, stay off of my cloud. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We're going to take a minute now and talk to Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, for what you can only call a timely installment of our series Codebreaker. It's all about technology and our daily lives. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
How much do we know about how all these pictures were hacked, stolen?
Well, let me talk to you just a little bit about your photos. Let's start there.
Okay.
How does that sound? I want to have the talk with you about your photos.
Okay.
First thing I want to tell you, if you, Kai Rizdahl, get hacked, you are probably never going to get your cloud storage company to take responsibility
for that. As we've seen with Apple, right? I mean, come on.
It's true. But this surprised me. This actually surprised me. So I talked to a VP at a cloud security firm this week named Tao Klein. The firm is called Adalom.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's about something called the mutual responsibility model.
The root of it is based on this very simple notion that if you willingly give away your credentials, then the cloud service provider cannot possibly be held accountable.
You willingly give away? I mean, who am I going to willingly give it away to?
Well, this is a good question, but they count anything, even if you don't know you're giving it away, right? So if you get phished, if somebody gets you to click on something and they hack into your computer or your phone,
That counts as willingly giving away?
That counts.
That's lame.
And every major cloud company, Dropbox, Apple's iCloud, Android, or Google Drive, if you will, they all use this idea of mutual responsibility in their terms of service.
Huh.
So when you agree to those terms of service, you're basically saying that, you know, whatever happens to your credentials, as long as the company doesn't give it away, as long as someone else gets it through you, then you, not the company, is held responsible.
Is there anything that I, the average user, can do to protect myself?
All right, so let's do a little experiment, Kai.
Right.
You got your phone on you?
I do.
All right.
I brought it in just for this.
Take it out if you would.
It's in my
hand. A photo. Okay. Nothing too, you know, keep it, you know,
all
keep
right,
it radio friendly.
I'm just gonna
take a photo.
Yeah, you know what's funny is all the producers are moving out of the line of fire in the control room, which is where I'm taking the picture of. All right, there we go. So I got a picture.
All right, so now do me a favor.
Yes.
Go to your settings.
All right.
Tell me when you're there.
I'm there.
All right. So go down to the area of your settings on your iPhone where you manage photos.
So I see my photo stream, photo sharing, summarize yes. photos. Yeah. Okay.
So my photo stream.
Yes.
Right? And is the switch on? Does it look green?
I'm going to win this one. It is off. It is not green.
Oh.
So I'm not sharing. I know. I'm the diligent citizen here, right?
You keep blowing my mind, man. This is impressive.
And you think I'm just some schmo.
Now, if it was green, you see that little bit of text down there, which
automatically
basically
upload new photos and send them to all of your iCloud devices when connected to Wi-Fi, which is just rife with possibilities for peril.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is the problem with the cloud. Huh. We have to give up some of our privacy potentially in order to have convenience.
With the aforementioned terms of service not necessarily being in our favor.
Exactly.
What's your photo sharing setting, dude?
Oh, man. It's not good.
See now?
I'm an opt-in kind of guy.
Practice what you preach, Joe. I know you are.
I know.
Be smart out there. Do it to them before they do it to you, will you? Be safe.
I know. But here's the thing is most of my photos are of my cat. And,
all right, that's
a whole
different interview. Ben Johnson, he's the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
There is more good stuff at Ben's Codebreaker blog. It is at marketplace.org. Of course, on Wall Street today, more down than up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now in news you can use, here is a quick hint that will let you add $590 million to the value of your company in just one day. All you got to do is hire Gisele Bündchen. That's what Under Armour did. The sportswear company has been hard at work marketing and building the brand, going straight after Nike by trying to steal away one of its most popular celebrity endorsers, NBA star Kevin Durant. That didn't quite work out, but the Brazilian supermodel sure did. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
It takes a lot of chutzpah to challenge Nike. Nike's sales are more than 8 times Under Armour's, but marketers say Under Armour has been smart, aggressive, and disciplined, just like its founder, Kevin Plank, a former football player at the University of Maryland, who, the story goes, hated his team's cotton t-shirts. They always got drenched in sweat.
So when he graduated from Maryland, he thought there was an opportunity to create a new t-shirt that would wick away moisture, that would be lighter to wear and far more comfortable than traditional cotton.
And he did, says Hal Birch, an advertising exec whose office sits right across Baltimore's Inner Harbor from Under Armour. Under Armour's customers have traditionally been male jocks. The company started by marketing to football teams, after all. But business professor Amna Kermani says that's changing.
They have a really good reputation with athletes and serious runners. But now they need to broaden their appeal to everyday individuals, people who are weekend warriors and so forth.
Not to mention the folks who never step near a gym but wear workout clothes anyway, to the grocery store, even the office. Marketers say hiring the world's top supermodel shows Under Armour understands we all want to be fit, but we want to be fashionable too. That is, if we can squeeze into those skin-tight workout pants as easily as she does. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
New York City has gotten just a little bit more glamorous the last couple of days. It is Fashion Week in New York again, which means Manhattan is more jammed than it usually is with stylists and models and celebrities and parties and runway shows and all of that. Every Fashion Week seems to be out to top the last one, with every designer trying to stand out from the crowd. Stan Elkhorn has the story.
One of the first big shows of Fashion Week is happening tonight in Central Park on horse-drawn carriages.
We'd like to refer to this as a moving runway.
Toby Rubenstein-Schneier of the Tahor Group dreamed up the idea as a way to stand out in an increasingly crowded field.
The horses are iconic in New York, and they're majestic and they're beautiful. You know, they're models themselves.
The ultra-hip label opening ceremony is putting on a one-act play. British designer Gareth Pugh is creating an immersive experience, whatever that is. And less established designers have been doing their own unconventional thinking. Emily Saunders would say only that her models wouldn't move, and that the theme of her collection is a song.
the 1968 Iron Butterfly song, Inagata Da Vida.
There's no question that cutting through the clutter is what every smart business person is trying to do today.
Allison Kenny-Paul is a retail analyst with Deloitte. The big change to Fashion Week, in her view, is how the internet and fast fashion have shortened the distance between the shows and the streets.
I believe that you're going to see some of the looks, if they really resonate with people, almost within weeks, not months. It's much more of a short runway, if you will.
Based on the economy, this season, Paul predicts more consumers at the end of that runway. That and more neutral colors. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Life's not fair. You learn that pretty early on. But it'd be great if things were at least close to equitable, right? Especially in tax policy. Property taxes, specifically. You pay taxes on the value of your house. But when that house gets valued depends very much on where that house is. Assessment is the official word you're looking for here. Audrey Quinn takes a look at the assessment controversy in one New York town.
For David Bunzel, the bad news came in a letter. In March,
I opened it up and, I mean, I was surprised.
Bunzel lives in Scarsdale, New York, just north of New York City. The town's doing its first townwide property value reassessments in 45 years. That letter Bunzel got, it came from the assessment office.
The estimated value from their perception of our home went up overnight by about 30%.
The estimated value of your home, that helps determine how much you pay in property taxes. Bunzel lives in a neighborhood of multi-million dollar homes. A 30% rise in his property taxes would be a lot of money. Things were even worse for some of his neighbors. Some even saw their assessments double. So Bunzel and a bunch of his neighbors are now challenging the revaluations.
Who has sympathy for these people? They were getting a great deal that we were paying for 45 years in many cases.
That's Robert Berg. He's another Scarsdale resident. And he was someone who really pushed for the property revaluations.
If someone's paying too little, someone's paying too much. And the whole purpose of a revaluation is to periodically and systematically review all the property valuations in town so that you can get equity in the tax rolls.
But New York State doesn't require periodic revaluations. They recommend cities reassess properties every few years. But some towns in the state haven't had property reassessments since the Civil War. New York's not alone in these infrequent assessments. In California, for example, your property tax gets based on how much you paid for your house. If you've been sitting on a home for 40 years, you're paying way less taxes than someone who bought a similar home at today's prices. Kim Rubin's a senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center at the Urban Institute. She says to avoid revaluation controversies like we're seeing in Scarsdale, like you see in California, cities need routine state-mandated property assessments. She says they keep property taxes smoother for everyone.
So some of this is much more political than fiscal, right? So the whole idea that you're not going to reassess properties has more to do with who has political power and who's going to end up being winners and losers.
She says reassessments usually put the biggest dent in the pocketbooks of the upscale homeowners. So politicians might avoid enforcing reassessments to avoid upsetting wealthy voters.
But it's never going to be any easier for them to do a reassessment.
She says at some point, towns that have held off on reassessments, they're going to have to bite the bullet. Scarsdale's property revaluations are still under review, but they should go into effect later this month. In Scarsdale, New York, I'm Audrey Quinn for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's a high-stakes treasure hunt in a way because they're saving these songs from certain death.
Well, it's not that gruesome, but it's bad. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it was a little mezza-mezza, a little come-see-come-sa on Wall Street. Today, the Dow Industrial is up 10 points, less than a tenth percent. 17,078 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 25 points. That is more than a half percent. Finished at 4,572. The S&P 500 dropped a point less than a tenth percent. ended the day at 2,000 on the nose. Home Depot shares fell more than 2% today as the retailer investigated a possible hack of its customer data. Shocking, I know. U.S. auto sales were robust in August, but the verdict on Wall Street was mixed. Shares in Chrysler's owner Fiat were up nearly 2.75% over in Italy, but both Ford and GM downshifted a bit here. Ford off 0.75%, GM off nearly 1%. Delta Airlines says there is rough air ahead, cutting projections for its per-passenger growth in the third quarter. Delta shares off more than 5% today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Did back-to-school shopping send consumers to the malls? Chain stores report sales figures for August. The Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in July. And here is something to tide you over while you're waiting for your favorite TV programs to premiere this fall. The NFL season begins with the Green Bay Packers playing the Seattle Seahawks. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the many questions raised by the celebrity photo thefts this past weekend is whether they will slow the momentum toward more people using and actually relying on cloud computing. They may, or they may not. We don't know yet. But one user group is definitely growing. Wyoming and Pennsylvania are moving most of their government data onto the cloud, and other states are thinking about it. From Wyoming Public Radio, Miles Bryan has that story.
From the outside, Cheyenne, Wyoming's Greenhouse Data Center looks fairly nondescript. Just another boring building in a corporate office park. But get past security, and it feels like something out of the Matrix. A long white hallway leads to row after row of blinking servers. Staff engineer Courtney Thompson says they're very well protected.
Laser grid-based systems on penetrations on the outside of our walls, Kevlar bulletproofing anywhere there's a window. We like to show people we go to the nth degree to make sure that our clients' data is secure.
The clients that use Greenhouse's cloud hosting services include New Belgium Brewing Company, the National Outdoor Leadership School, and now the state of Wyoming.
We're getting higher quality servers, higher quality data protection, so it's more economical to us, but we're also getting far more bang for the buck.
Flint Waters is Wyoming's chief information officer. He's leading the transition of most of the state's data from state-owned servers to the cloud. That's space on the internet rented from big data companies. It's like a giant version of Dropbox or Google Drive. He says there are tons of benefits. He gets access to the very best IT guys, and the state only has to pay for the storage it needs. Water says there's no way Wyoming can compete with companies that manage data for a living.
When it comes time to get a bunch of new trucks for our fleet, we don't say, let's put together a factory and assemble trucks. We look at GM, Ford, Chrysler, and this is a very similar paradigm.
But while a majority of states are looking into the cloud, last year, a nationwide survey found that most states are worried it could violate privacy laws. Waters says he understands the concern, but he says government-owned servers definitely aren't any safer.
Folks said, well, it's more secure because I control the server. Well, yeah, but I can pick it up and walk out the door to my car with it, and that citizen data isn't secure anymore.
If you are controlling your own data center, you have the control that matches your responsibility. When you move into the cloud, something could go wrong.
Li Tian is an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He points to an example out of California as a reason to worry. School kids there use a cloud service called Google Apps for Education. But last spring, it came out that Google had been clandestinely mining their emails for ad research. Tian says governments need to be good stewards of their citizens' data.
There's a tendency for there not to be a whole lot of public oversight over these kinds of decisions, even when they actually can be quite fateful for everyone involved.
So where can a little government turn for advice when navigating the very complex world of cloud computing?
Australia has always been a country where the citizens have valued their privacy.
John Sheridan is Australia's information minister. Australia is moving a lot onto the cloud too. And last year, it came out with one of the most extensive guides to data privacy out there. Sheridan says government cloud computing contracts need to be able to hold private companies accountable.
We need to look at their security, so we don't want someone hacking our websites or doing those sorts of things.
And Sheridan says if there is a hack, governments need to be sure they'll know about it and know how it'll get fixed quickly. In Cheyenne, IT guy Courtney Thompson would be one of those fixers if something went wrong. He says Wyoming is just the beginning for states heading to the cloud.
With these massive computing facilities, it's really kind of the way of the future in computing.
Wyoming plans to start moving its government data over in the next few months, one careful step at a time. In Cheyenne, Wyoming, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
Working backward in the chronology of recorded music, recorded on records specifically, we've got vinyl LPs, corresponding singles known as 45s, and way back 100 or more years ago, 78s. Those records are now, as are many things that are old and rare, cherished collectibles. Amanda Petrovich writes about the 78s and the people who want them in her new book. It's called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Amanda, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much, Kai. Happy to be here.
Probably ought to remind people what 78s are, right?
Sure. 78 RPM records are 10-inch grooved shellac discs that were introduced around the turn of the century, mostly phased out by the 1960s. They spun at 78 revolutions per minute, hence the name, and contain about 2 to 3 minutes of music on each side.
I offer this next question as a history guy and a person who is intrigued by this stuff, but who are the obsessives in your subtitle who are going to look for these things that are hard to store and breakable and old and stuff?
I mean, this oddball fraternity, and it is a fraternity, it's mostly men, but the ones that began to interest me in particular were sort of fervently focused, almost maniacally focused on preserving the music that was recorded to these discs. There are no metal masters for many of these early American recordings.
I'm sorry, no metal, right? As in no hard masters.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so the records themselves that were pressed, we don't, you know, that's all we have. It's the only evidence we have that these songs were made. So it's a high-stakes treasure hunt in a way because they're saving these songs from certain death.
How are they sold in the marketplace, if you will? I mean, do you find them on people's driveways on a Sunday afternoon garage sale? Are they specialized?
You do still hear those stories, but more often than not, they are traded either on eBay or even more frequently, sort of private trades among collectors, sometimes for astounding amounts of money. I mean, there was a very public sale recently on eBay of a record for $37,000.
Wow.
You know, and that's not uncommon.
I am obliged to point out here that you, too, got a little obsessed. I mean, there's a passage in this book where you talk about learning to scuba dive so you can look in like, what, Lake Michigan or something for some 78s that were supposed to be sunk? I mean, hello.
Absolutely. God, I sadly, or sort of, I don't know, proudly at this point, maybe,
totally.
I count myself among them.
Own it.
It did ultimately lead me to the bottom of the Milwaukee River, which is not a place I'd recommend for other scuba divers.
Put on your academician's hat here for a minute and give me the theory behind the collecting of these things, because it's a little bit like some computer guy being interested in those big old floppy disks that used to be you have to put them in computers, you know, like 20, 30 years ago.
Right. For me, it became a kind of psychological puzzle about, you know, why ownership was so important to these guys. And there is an archetype of the collector in place. I think people think of, you know, Steve Buscemi's character from Ghost World or, you know, it's not a particularly flattering stereotype. There's the sense that these are, you know, older, sort of pale and kind of doughy middle-aged men. By and large, that proved to not be entirely true. But the idea that these are men that feel in some way, you know, sort of isolated by or excluded from modernity is very much true. And I think they end up ultimately collecting these things as a way of sort of insulating themselves from that or slowing down the acceleration of culture that we see happening.
As the records become rarer and rarer, are we losing the music that's on them, or has that been digitized somehow so we can find that online in 20 years if we wanted to?
Collectors would talk to me about that often. I mean, that sense of discovery where they find some record they've never seen before, they put it on, and it's, you know, it's a total masterpiece. Of course, that happens way less frequently than the thing where, you know, they find a record and they put it on and it turns out to be terrible. Not all old records are good, but there is some sense that we don't even really know what could have fallen through the cracks. The bulk of, I would say, certain canons, pre-war blues, most of those records have been found and have been digitized and are now available to buy on iTunes for 99 cents.
Of course they are, because, you know, Apple. It's a book called Do Not Sell at Any Price by Amanda Petrovich. Amanda, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, and I know this is going to make me sound incredibly dull, but so be it. I actually enjoy reading about the Beige Book, the Federal Reserve's regular look at regional slices of the American economy. The latest installment came out today, and so we know, thanks to the Wall Street Journal, that theme park attendance in and around Atlanta was soft because family vacations were delayed due to snow day makeups at the end of the last school year, and that aerospace manufacturers near San Francisco are worried about titanium supplies because of sanctions on Russia. And my personal favorite, we know that a mildew outbreak in North Dakota may reduce sunflower yields come harvest time. Come on. Fascinating, right? All right, no. We got to go. The Dow up 10 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ gave back 25 points, more than a half percent. The S&P 500 down a point, less than a 10%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.